listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Service. Welcome to our regulars, to our visitors, to people who haven't been here for a long time. Jane, I'm not talking about you, am I? It's fabulous to see you here again. No matter what your gender identity or preference, ethnicity or faith tradition, you're welcome. This is a space of thoughtfulness and kindness of a Sunday. We're not here to sign up for the same team or affirm the same beliefs, but to support each other in following our own path. Any path that helps us create stronger communities and a better world. A world in which we embrace diversity, justice, democracy, and the interdependence of all living things. Unitarians have been meeting on Kaurna and Piramank lands for almost as long as the state of South Australia existed. We recognise the importance of Indigenous culture and language and the authority of First Nation people in expressing and sharing their care for country for the benefit of all. We're going to begin today's service with the hymn All the Welcome Here. It's in the green hymnal, but I'm going to put the words up on the screen because they're short. To contribute, cash in the grey chalice or use your card on the cash point and you can tap it as many times as you like. Ten bucks a pop. So, thanks Brendan. Today's story of all ages will be a nostalgia jag for those who had a childhood in the 40s and 50s, maybe not for those whose early years were in the 60s, and almost definitely not for Generation X, Millennials and even Youngers. We will have a short discussion afterwards about what dates this particular story, hence the questions on the screen. Was it interesting or boring? Would you read this to your children, grandies, nieces and nephews? If not, why not? And what would they not get without explanation? Now, I never read Br'er Rabbit stories as a child. Dad read them to us because the English was unfamiliar, it being a Joel Chandler Harris original. This version was written for British children by Jane Shaw, so I'm not constrained to read it in an archaic Afro-American accent, but it doesn't work particularly well with my version of Australian either, so we're going to have to sort of compromise. Well then, said Uncle Remus, there was one time when old Br'er Rabbit was going to town after something or other for the family, and he was almost ashamed to go because his shoes were teetotal, practically worn out. Yet he wanted to go, so he put as good a face on it as he can, and he take his walking stick, and he set out just as big as the next one. Well then, old Br'er Rabbit go on down the big road till he come to a place where some folk had been camping out the night before, and he sat down to warm his feet by the fire, because the mornings were sort of cold, like these here mornings. He sat there and looking at his toes, feeling mighty sorry for himself. Well, then he sat there, and it wasn't long before he hears something trot-trotting along the road, and here come Mr. Dog, a-smelling and a-snuffling around to see what folks had left of scraps round the campfire. Mr. Dog was all dressed up in his Sunday go-to-meeting clothes, and more than that, he had on brand-new shoes. Well, Br'er Rabbit see them shoes, and he feel mighty bad, but he doesn't let on. He bowed to Mr. Dog, mighty polite, and Mr. Dog, he bow back. And Br'er Rabbit say, Mr. Dog, where are you going all fixed up like this? I'm going to town, Br'er Rabbit, where are you going? Oh, I thought I'd go to town myself and get me a new pair of shoes, because my old ones are worn out and they hurts my foot so bad I can't wear them. They're mighty fine shoes you got on, Mr. Dog. Where'd you get them? Down in town, Br'er Rabbit. Down in town. Br'er Rabbit talked so mighty sweet that Mr. Dog sat flat down on the ground and took off one of his behind shoes and lent it to Br'er Rabbit. Br'er Rabbit, he lope off down the road and then he comes back and he tell Mr. Dog, the shoe fits mighty for nice, but with one of them on, it make him sort of lopsided. He come back, he did, he said, they're mighty nice, Mr. Dog. Mr. Dog pull off the other behind shoe and Br'er Rabbit put it on to try it. And Br'er Rabbit trotted down the road and came back and said, they're mighty nice, Mr. Dog, but they sort of raised me up from behind. I really don't know exactly how they feel. So Mr. Dog, wanting to be polite, took off the before shoes, and Br'er Rabbit put them on and stomp his foots and allow, nah, that sort of feels like shoes. He rack off down the road, and then when he gets going to where he ought to turn round, he just laid back his ears and kept going, and it wasn't long before he was out of sight. Mr. Dog, he holler and tell him to come back, but Br'er Rabbit kept on going. Mr. Dog, he holler. Mr. Rabbit kept on going. And down to this day, Mr. Dog has been running after Br'er Rabbit. And if you just go out in the woods with any dog on this place, the minute he smells rabbit, he'll holler and yell for him to come back. Let's just break, and just with the people around you, I could hear a lot of chuckles, but look at the demographic. You might have enjoyed it, but would you subject your children to it?
Have a chat.
And I think we might bring that little discussion to an end. I'd be surprised if anybody would go home now and read it to a very young child. I think some of the points are that the context was pretty dreadful, very, very racist and so on, although there's a bit of fun in them. Now, it's time in our service when we light candles for joys, concerns, or insights. I'd just like to remind people to be brief and to refrain from comment about anybody else's candle. After all, the time for discussion and comment is afterwards when the person has right of reply. And it's okay to come and light a silent candle. I will light the first candle and then open the floor for other people to light a candle. I've got a reading today from a dust jacket and it's from Thomas Piketty's Brief History of Equality. Now, it's very easy to be pessimistic about inequality. We know it has increased dramatically in many parts of the world over the past two generations, and no one has done more to reveal the problem than Thomas Piketty. But in this surprising and powerful new work, Brief History of Equality, he reminds us that the grand sweep of history gives us reasons to be optimistic. Over the centuries, he shows, we have been moving toward greater equality. In particular, with the building of the welfare state, we may have had a history of violence and social struggle, punctuated by regressions and disaster, but through it all, human societies have moved fitfully toward a more just distribution of income and assets, a reduction of racial and gender inequalities, and greater access to healthcare, education, and citizenship rights. Our rough march forward is political and ideological. It's an endless fight against injustice. To keep moving, Piketty argues, we need to learn and commit to what works, to institutional, legal, social, fiscal, and educational systems that can make equality a lasting reality. At the same time, we need to resist historical amnesia and temptations of cultural separatism and intellectual compartmentalization. At stake is the quality of life for billions of people. We know we can do better, Piketty concludes. The past shows us how. The future is up to us. Time for a little silence. You may like to bow your heads, close your eyes if you like. I will preface this prayer with the thought of Søren Kierkegaard's on the subject of prayer, and it is, the function of prayer is not to influence God, but rather to change the nature of one who prays. May diversity be a source of enrichment and expansion of our humanity, and not a source of alienation, injustice, oppression, and wounding. Fill hearts of all people with love and the desire to ensure justice for all brothers and sisters. By sharing the good things of the earth, may we secure justice and equality for every human being, an end to all division, and a human society built on love and peace. Last week, Brendan played a piece that people did not assume was written by Debussy, not only because of the sound, but also because of the title, The Golliwog's Cakewalk. Debussy wrote it when jazz was all the rage in Paris and golliwogs were a popular toy. It was also a time when people who looked like the toy had neither the motivation nor the confidence to object to the design. Very dark skin, large white-rimmed eyes, red or white clown lips, wild frizzy hair, bow tie, stand-up white collar, a caricature of the American blackface minstrel. So who were they? Well, they were white guys sending up the appearance of black guys for the purpose of musical entertainment. For centuries, black music, forged in bondage, has been the sound of complete artistic freedom. No wonder everybody's always stealing it. This was written by Wesley Morris in 2019 in the 1618 Project. He goes on to explain that the person most frequently identified as the prime mover of blackface is Thomas Dartmouth Rice, a New Yorker who performed as T.D. Rice and in acclaim was lusted after as Daddy Rice, the Negro par excellence. Rice was a minstrel, which by the 1830s, when his stardom was at its height, meant he painted his face with burnt cork to approximate those of the enslaved black people he was imitating. Now, in 1830, Rice was a nobody actor in his early 20s, touring with a company in Cincinnati or Louisville. Well, the historians don't actually know. And the story goes he saw a decrepit, possibly disfigured old black man singing while he was grooming a horse on the property of a white man whose name was Crow. On went the light bulb. Rice took in the tune and the movements, but failed, it seems, to take down the old man's name. So in his song, based on the horse groomer, he renamed him, "Every time I wheel around, I jump Jim Crow." And just like that, Rice had invented the fellow who would become the mascot for two centuries of legalized racism. Rice turned an old man's melody and hobbled movements into a song and dance routine that no white audience had ever experienced before. And what they saw caused a permanent sensation. He won 20 encores in one performance. He repeated the act night after night for audiences so profoundly rocked that he was frequently mobbed during performances. As slaves were being worked, sometimes to death, white people, desperate with anticipation, were paying to see them depicted at play. Perhaps minstrelsy's popularity could be read as the urge to escape reckoning. But a good time predicated upon the presentation of other human beings as stupid, docile and dangerous, with lust and enamoured, well, it's an escape into the slavery's funhouse. So how did the minstrel become a toy? Well, Florence Kate Upton was the daughter of an English emigre, lived in New York, and she wrote a children's story. The story begins with Peg and Sarah Jane on the loose in a toy shop, encountering a horrid sight, the blackest gnome. The little black gnome wore bright red trousers, red bow tie on a high-collared white shirt, and a blue swallowtail coat. He was a caricature of the American black-faced minstrels. In effect, a caricature of a caricature. And she called him Gollywog. Two L's, two G's. The Gollywog was based on a black minstrel doll that Upton had played with as a small child in New York, and this would have been a homemade knit version. The then nameless Negro minstrel doll was treated roughly by the Upton children. Upton reminisced, "Seated upon a flower pot in the garden, his kindly face was a target for rubber balls, the game being to knock him over backwards. It pains me now to think of those little rag legs flying ignominiously over his head. That was a long time ago, and before he'd become a personality. We knew he was ugly." Well, the Upton Gollywog was adventurous and sometimes silly, but in the main, gallant, lovable, albeit unsightly. But later Gollywogs were often unkind, mean-spirited, and definitely ugly. The earliest Gollywog dolls were rag dolls made by parents for their children, but during the 20th century, many prominent doll manufacturers began producing them. Steiff, Schuco, Levan in Germany, Mary Thornton Deans, Great Britain. In 1908, Steiff became the first company to mass-produce them. Today, Steiff dolls sell for $10,000 to $15,000 each, making them the most expensive Gollywog collectibles. Some Steiff Gollywogs are especially offensive. For example, in the 1970s, they produced one that looked like a gorilla, woolly gorilla. In 1995, it was the 100th anniversary of the company's first one, they produced the company's first girl Gollywog. Progress? James Robertson and Son, a British manufacturer of jams and preserves, began using the Gollywog as its trademark in the early 1900s. Golly appeared on product labels, price lists, and advertising material, and its appeal led to an enormously popular mail-away campaign. In return for coupons for their marmalade, people got badges. The first was Golly Golfer in 1928, and then a series of fruit badges, but in 1939 it was discontinued. Can you think why? Yeah, exactly, Pauline. The metal was needed for the war effort. But by 1946, Golly returned. In 1999, Robertson spokesperson said, "He's still very popular. Since 1910, we've sent out more than 20 million. The Robertson Golly has also appeared on pencils, knitting patterns, playing cards, aprons and children's silverware set. During the first half of the 20th century, Gollywog was number two soft toy. Number one was teddy bear. Small children slept with their black dolls. Many Europeans still speak with nostalgic sentiment about their childhood gollies. Sir Kenneth Clark the noted art historian, claimed that gollywogs of his child were examples of chivalry, far more pervasive than the unconvincing knights of the Arthurian legend. And Claude Debussy was so enthralled by gollywogs in his daughter's books that one movement of his children's corner suite is entitled The Gollywog's Cakewalk. The gollywog was a mixture of bravery, adventurousness, and love for white children. In the 1960s, relations between blacks and whites in England were often characterised by conflict. The racial antagonism resulted from many factors, including the arrival in increasing numbers of coloured immigrants, the minorities' unwillingness to accommodate themselves to the old patterns of racial and ethnic subordination, and the fear among many whites that England was losing its national character. British culture was also influenced by images of racial conflict, often brutal, occurring in the States. In America, meanwhile, there was a campaign against Little Black Sambo. Racial minorities and sympathetic whites argued that these Sambos and Gollies demeaned blacks and hurt the psyches of the minority. Civil rights organisations led both campaigns, and white civic and political leaders eventually joined the effort to ban these offensive caricatures. 10 Little Niggers, children's poem, celebrates the deaths of 10 black children one by one, was also the name of a 1939 Agatha Christie novel whose cover showed a gollywog being lynched. Not very subtle, is it? The gollywog's reputation and popularity were further hurt by the association of the word wog. Wog is an English slur against dark-skinned people, particularly Middle East and Far East foreigners. During World War II, wog was used by the British Army in North Africa, mainly as a slur against dark-skinned Arabs. Some gollywog supporters tried to distance themselves from this wog stuff by just calling the toy golly. James Robertson and Sons did that. In the late 1980s, when the anti-gollywog campaign reached its height, many of the small manufacturers began using the name golly. Not surprisingly, the next step was for the words golly and gollywog to become racial slurs, used at football matches and that sort of thing, and it ended up being just as demeaning as wog anyway. It is a racial slur in Germany, England, Ireland, Greece and Australia, and it's applied to dark-skinned whites as well as brown-skinned persons. Gollywog is a common name for black pets, especially dogs, in European countries, much as nigger was once a popular pet's name. Ow! The gollywog celebrated its 100th year anniversary in 1995 and collectibles boomed on the secondary market. Many collectors, primarily, though not exclusively white, contend that the anti-gollywog movement represents political correctness at its worst. They argue that golly is just a doll, that the original Florence Upton creation was not racist intentionally or unintentionally, and this is reminiscent of the claims made about Helen Bannerman's Little Black Sambo. The point is, the gollywog was created in a racist era. He was drawn as a caricature of a minstrel, which itself represented a demeaning image of blacks. There's racial stereotyping of black people in Florence Upton's books. Certainly, the gollywogs often reflected negative beliefs about blacks. In Enid Blyton, the gollywogs are thieves, miscreants in incompetence. There is little doubt that the words associated with gollywog are often used as racial slurs to this day. And finally, the resurgence of interest in the gollywog is not found among children. It's found among adults. Some of them are nostalgic, but others have financial interests. That little collection of badges I showed you, McRobertson, that's £330 worth in the English money. It's astonishing. Now, the most recent gollywog story I read last week, it's on Thursday the 5th, was in The Guardian. A pub in Essex was closed because the suppliers, Heineken, Carlsberg and Inserv, who service the lines and pumps, withdrew their services. The owner said they would never get over the stigma of a police raid in which her gollywogs were confiscated by the police. They had them on a display. The Home Secretary was accused of reprimanding the police for being heavy-handed. The police deny being reprimanded. It's unsubstantiated. The owner of the Gollies said, if people think Gollies look like them, that's their problem. My Gollies are doing no harm. People don't have to come through that door. It was true enough, but to square that, this is the sign she put up in the pub. White Lives Matter. The objections were dismissed as Snowflake's complaints. The husband, Chris Riley, had Facebook posts up in which he compared the dolls to lynchings in Mississippi and expressed backing for far-right groups. His account's been deleted. My own view is that the Gollywog has had its day and has accumulated far too much baggage. The people for whom it was a lovely, comforting toy were not necessarily racist. The ones who kicked it around and used it for target practice were racist. Its popularity soared in white populations where kids were not going to be teased because they didn't have black hair, black skin or frizzy hair. Their parents were charmed by the child's affection for the toy. The connection with abuse and slavery was not in the cultural foreground. That happened with the race riots in the 60s. Now, in Unitarian churches, our common opening hymn is the one we had today. All are welcome here. We aspire to take people in as they are and impose no requirements of dogma for them to attend our services or join our community. We honour each individual and their unique experience and contribution. But despite our welcome, we fall short. And this is because we welcome people on our own terms without realising. A congregational culture is not created in isolation, but reflects the society of which we're part. It draws on histories and events long forgotten, but replicated. This is why the issues raised by Black Matters matter. In the UK, Derek McCauley is chair of the Hibbett Trust. This supports building and social justice projects. The original founder was an active Unitarian with strong beliefs, and he wrote that all men are naturally equal. But he was the owner. You know what's coming, don't you? He was the owner of slave plantations in Jamaica, and he received substantial compensation when slavery was abolished. The funds were used to enhance the privileges already possessed, and in only comparatively recent times has spending been reoriented to combat racial injustice and support marginalised groups. White privilege doesn't mean your life hasn't been hard. It means your skin colour isn't one of the things that's making it harder. Poor white children do not have the privilege of the comparative wealth of the majority, and poverty has knock-on effects including health, diet, job prospects, education. And of course there are many people of colour who are financially and educationally privileged, like the Prime Minister of England, Rishi Sunak, and the wonderful Kane Mason family. But no amount of material advantage excludes the significant microaggressions experienced in daily life, not to mention actual discrimination. I remember after COVID, when the concerts came back, Sheku's passport was confiscated. Why? He'd been profiled as a young black guy. His sister hadn't. Thousands and thousands of protests got him the passport and he managed to get to the concerts that was being blocked from in France and Germany. Now, in recent General Assembly surveys in the UK, these were findings, very, very recent surveys. 92% of Unitarians of colour report being asked, where are you from? 50% got the follow-up, no, where are you really from? And after they explained that they'd been born in Brixton or Highgate, they were then asked, only by 8% admittedly, what's your family's ethnic origin? More recent migrants get the I couldn't understand what they said treatment, or 42% had it explained to them that racism was in the past and we just need to get over it and just take jocular remarks as jocular. 75% report experiencing the comment, "I don't see colour." And 66% heard, "I treat all people the same, regardless of colour." The catch is, white people are often unaware of the invisibility mask made up of clothes, shoes, politics, speech that black citizens don to make their experiences conform to the majority community. This can become exhausting and psychologically undermining. The author of Learning to be White, Thandika, was asked, in good faith, by a peer in a tertiary institution, "What's it like being black?" Her interlocutor simply believed that nothing from her own background could help her understand a black woman's experience. She promised to answer the question at lunch in a week time if the other woman played the race game. Now, there's only one rule in the race game, and that is you have to use the descriptive term white every time you refer to a white person. My white husband, Phil. My white friend, Julie. My lovely white granddaughter, Jackie. Needless to say, there was no second lunch. Imagine the excruciating embarrassment of using that term consistently when you're supposed to be above all that redneck nonsense. You don't see yourself as white, as other people may be black or Asian, but consciously you're not white. The feelings that the word white provoked were deeply shaming, and these feelings of shame came from early childhood, which is when children learn they're not black, they're white, but you don't say so. The shame comes from betraying black playmates or from suddenly realising you're not supposed to invite black friends over to the family barbecue. Thandika's thesis is, number one, nobody is born white. The first racial victim of the white community is its own child, and racist acts are often motivated not by racist sentiment, but by feelings of personal shame. Now, my own memory is the cinema. All the black kids, this is 1959, 1960, all the black kids sat down the front, and you sort of knew you couldn't go and sit there. And you also kind of knew that you couldn't ask them to come back and sit with you, but you also know you didn't go home and ask why. It was just wrong. My parents didn't like to go to the cinema at all. Apartheid wasn't their style. But they weren't going to stir the pot by picking a fight with the people in a remote mining town, and only one policeman. Dad was prepared to correct kids at school for using racial epithets and tackle parents who didn't want their kids sitting next to Aboriginal children because they'll get head lice. He was very quick to get the nurse in to treat any kid with cooties, and our teachers were instructed to sit Indigenous kids next to my sister or me, or next to the field manager's kids or various other prominent people in the place, if there was any fuss being made by parents of ETSA employees. But the town cinema for Dad was another matter. It wasn't under his jurisdiction. Now, we need to get away from two well-trodden paths. On the right, what are we going to do about them? What do they want now? Why can't they take care of themselves? Why won't they take responsibility? It's on the right. And on the left, how can we show them they're doing the wrong thing? How can we stop them being racist? Why won't they give up some of their privileges? Why don't they care? Our prayer should be, let's walk together. One program I've been told about involved congregants meeting weekly and confessing their slip-ups, like rolling up the window and locking the car door when approached for help by a black person. All a bit like an AA meeting, really. You'd tell you a little story and be asked questions and given feedback by the Afro-Americans who ran the sessions. New members of the sessions were not allowed to speak at all for the first fortnight. Does that seem extreme? Well, maybe not in a country in which black kids' first driving lessons, not put your seatbelt on and have a look in the rear vision mirrors. It's the first lesson is, if you are pulled over by the police, do not take your hands off the wheel. And that's not something that white kids necessarily get told at all until quite late in their driving lesson time. Every week, there's another report of a young black person being shot or choked. May the 3rd this week, Jock Neely, subway rider, death deemed a homicide. He was a Michael Jackson impersonator. He was hungry, he was thirsty, and he was wailing about it on the train. A 24-year-old member of the general public decided to put a stop to it and put a chokehold on him to shut him up. Now, he was obviously mentally unstable because he was carrying on, but how come no one on the carriage just tried giving him a bottle of water to settle him down? It's time to recognise that terms like white privilege or Black Lives Matter are not the problem. There are many kinds of privilege and underprivilege, and all are shocking reflections on our society which tolerates and perpetuates them. I'm going to close today with the words of Reverend Winnie Gordon, a Unitarian minister in Birmingham, the UK, currently serving. Unitarianism, she says, needs to do better if we truly want to live up to the standard of inclusivity. It's time we dismantle a cultural system of lifetimes and examine the white supremacy culture we have upheld. We are all diverse with different identities from different regions, cultures, and heritages. When conversation of race or racism happens, many make the accusation of division mongering. But our identities are different. And as a spiritual community that actually believes in inclusivity, our job is to affirm those differences in a way that celebrates and uplifts the dignity and worth of every person. Beloved community is formed not by the eradication of difference, but by its affirmation, by each of us claiming the identities and cultural legacies that shape who we are and how we live in the world. We deepen those bondings by connecting with an anti-racist struggle. I pray we do.
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitariansa.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitariansa.org.au.